When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I started warming up. I tell the catcher to get down. First pitch, bah, dotted. Outside corner. Second pitch, boom, dotted. On the black. Third pitch, bang, dotted. I didn't throw a strike the rest of the pen after the first three.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, we are breaking tradition a little bit as we've got an active player on the show, talking to Trevor Hildenberger, freshly activated by the Giants to finish out the minor league season after a long rehab process. Trevor took a break in between rehab outings to walk me through his career thus far and his hopes for the remainder of his time in baseball. We talk about his time at Cal, where for 3 years, Trevor was a garbage time reliever, the guy who pitches in blowouts and pretty much nothing else. So much so that when Cal's program was cut before the fall of 2010 in his sophomore year, he was ready to give up baseball entirely. Before his redshirt junior season on a whim, he threw sidearm during a bullpen, and that single action put him on a path to the big leagues. He walks me through his second chance at baseball, life in the minors, the process of learning how to be a big leaguer, and why a minor league union will benefit the game of baseball as a whole. I was really glad Trevor could stop by. If you follow him on Twitter, very cerebral dude. A really enjoyable conversation. Hope everyone checks it out. I'm excited to see what the next few years look like for Trevor. Episodes from Phenom of the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA Podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. Minor League Baseball season is winding down. BA is announcing Organization Players of the Year and previewing the Arizona Fall League. Great podcast on that just dropped yesterday, so go check that out. Lots of good stuff going on at BA, as always. With that, let's talk to Trevor Hildenberger. All right, joining in for today's episode from Phenom to the Farm, he was a 22nd round pick at the Twins in the 2014 out of Cal, big league right-hander and current member of the Giants organization, Trevor Hildenberger. Trevor, thank you so much for joining from Phenom to the Farm.
Happy to be here, Kyle. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I've been excited for this. Don't often have active players on, and you especially coming off a long injury rehab. Is getting back in the swing of being active, is it like riding a bike, like getting back in the I'm not rehabbing, I'm actually playing now, I'm on the team, I'm having to keep that schedule. Is it easy to jump back in?
Yeah, it's pretty easy. I think I've chomped a bit to get back to games for a long time now. And it's easy to get to remember, you know, what it's like to compete and to compete on a daily basis and to be ready on a daily basis. But one thing that I definitely have forgotten on the days are, because I think in rehab, the days are 4 to 5 hours. You kind of crank out your work. You get there, you stretch, roll out, you know, hot tub, do whatever you need to get ready. You do your throwing, you do your running, your lifts, your arm care, you get treatment, and then you go home. And you do all that stuff, and then you watch a 3-hour baseball game and possibly pitch. So the days are just quite a little bit longer than I remember. But in terms of pitching and competing between the lines, yeah, just like riding a bike.
I've got to ask, you've pitched before we take it all the way back to your amateur ball days. You've pitched in the big leagues in some really intense games. How do the nerves compare getting back on the mound for the first time in months and months and months in a low A game?
I get the same butterflies. I do. I think I've always been taught that if you're not nervous, you're not ready. You don't care. And so I always get those excited, anxious butterfly feelings. And that's kind of what I love about the game. Like, I can't simulate that really in any other environment. I think it's cranked up to a whole new level in a big league stadium with more on the line. You know, I have pitched in, I've been fortunate enough to pitch in some big spots, and that's just so much fun. It's so much fun. And I hope to get back there soon. But anytime you compete and you have, you know, eight guys behind you who are trying to make plays, and they're all playing for, you know, to help you get out. So it's the same spirit, and I do get the same nerves.
Well, I'm glad you're back out there. Let's take it all the way back to your amateur ball days. When did you first realize that you had a future at the next level of baseball, like college baseball?
Probably my end of my sophomore year, maybe junior year of high school. I think my freshman year, I played a lot, but I wasn't particularly good. I played outfield, I pitched, and I was a contributing member of the team, but it wasn't special. And then my sophomore year, I don't know what happened, but I grew quite a bit. And I didn't like grow into my body. I was a string bean. I was very thin, but I was throwing harder. And I could do a couple things that other guys couldn't do. I could spin a breaker for a strike whenever I needed to. And I was throwing pretty hard. So as a sophomore in high school, I made varsity. We were in a decent league and I pitched a lot. I had success. And then I started getting letters. I think at the end of my sophomore year, I started getting letters from colleges and I saw, wow, I could keep playing maybe. You know, this could be a thing for another few years.
So by the time you're in high school, perfect game is kind of at, I don't want to say it's apex, but like it's rolling. It's a thing now. You and I are actually the same graduating class. So,
09, baby.
09, class of 09. It is, man, that is way longer ago than I like to remember. Perfect game by all their math, had you ranked 1,852nd nationally. Something I'm sure they put a lot of thought and math behind, but the obsession with like
1,181st. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's big time. I mean, not ranked in the state of California, but ranked nationally somehow. But so with that, like you've got the D1 commit, that thing. Did you feel like a future big leaguer? Did you have those kind of aspirations for yourself even in high school?
Oh, I definitely had my aspirations there. I didn't, I never wavered in the belief in myself, I think. I ended up going to area codes and I pitched there, and that's what I think got me the Cal scholarship offer. I had some smaller schools offer me to play and some just in my backyard here in San Jose, and I really didn't want to stay at home and I didn't want to be that close to home. I kind of wanted to get out of here. So I was a that it felt like a different world, but it was still close enough to see my parents and my family. And it was also the only Pac-12 school that offered me a scholarship. So the weight that that carried, and especially academically, I felt like that was the coolest, best opportunity for me.
I'm curious because you're fairly cerebral dude. I follow you on Twitter. You have other interests outside of baseball. You also get interested in the thinking aspects of baseball. How, I guess, how do I word this? How like baseball diehard, baseball or nothing were you in high school and growing up? Did you allow yourself to have other interests, do other things, actually think about what you were going to study, or were you, I'm a baseball player, I'm going to worry about stuff, when I'm done playing?
That's a great question. I want to say that it kind of ebbed and flowed. There were different periods of my life where I was diehard baseball and baseball only. I thought about baseball 23 hours a day, and the other hour I was just eating. So it was my life for definitely certain windows. And then at other times I would get really into other stuff. I think I have a very addictive and passionate personality where I can really pour myself into something if I find it interesting enough. But baseball has always been my true love. I think my parents told me that I taught myself to read by looking at the newspaper and trying to find what time the Giants game was going to be on, and reading about Marvin Bernard was leading off that night, like trying to read the lineup. So
Man, remember some guys.
yeah, now we're just naming some guys, but yeah, baseball is something I've always loved. I've always been super passionate about. I think I fell out of love with it when I got to college for a little bit. I had a hard time managing my time and setting priorities in terms of school and sleep and social life and then baseball. And so I didn't take that next step. You know, everybody in high school is the best guy on their team. And then you get to college, especially a D1 school like Cal, where I thought that I was playing up in the first place. And then I got there and everyone was as good, if not better than me, and definitely stronger and bigger. And so I thought, this is it. You know, this is kind of as far as it goes. And this is as good as I'm going to get. This after my freshman year, I pitched 2 innings. And I tried really hard, but I didn't get any better. And I got hit really hard in fall ball and scrimmages and all that. And then my sophomore year, we were stacked. I had a lot of talent. We go to the College World Series in 2011. After our program gets cut in the fall. So this was technically our last year. And other guys were getting recruited by other schools to go transfer and continue their careers. And I wasn't getting any phone calls, any letters. So I thought, okay, this is it. You know, I'll hang it up. I'll stay at Cal. I'll get my degree. And that's going to be it for me in baseball.
So you were going to, when the Cal program gets cut the fall of your sophomore year. So you guys have all this time. And you took that time and you decided, I'm done with baseball. I'm just going to stay at Cal.
Yeah, September 2010, we got cut along with rugby and I think field hockey and a couple other sports.
Gymnastics,
yes. And I thought I had come to terms with baseball being out of my life and my career being over. I was hanging them up. And that was that. And then, you know, we go to the College World Series, and thanks to a lot of generous donations and fundraising, we actually raised enough money to save the program. And so I got to keep playing. My junior year, I pitched 10 more innings. And then at the end of my junior year is probably the biggest moment in my baseball career is when I switched sidearm.
Before that, after that, I mean, you're at a point where you're willing to walk away from baseball. You're not pitching very much. You're on a good team. You're not pitching very much. Your junior year, you get a few more innings, but you are, and I'm saying this as someone who was that guy, you're the garbage time guy. Like when I was in college, anytime a game started getting out of hand one way or the other, I'm like, this is my time to shine, baby. 12-0, daddy's going to the bullpen.
Yeah.
At that point, do you think you were content with who you were as a baseball player? Like, did you still have, when you're having this junior year, and like, I'm sure guys on your team are gunning for the draft. You're playing guys every weekend who are going to play 100% going to play pro ball. Were you just content with who you were? Was there still that drive to be your best, or did you think you would hit a ceiling?
Hell no. I was not content with who I was and how my career was going to end. I had come to terms with it, and I thought I had hit my ceiling. I really did, but I wasn't happy about it. I mean, I was disappointed in the fact that I wasn't good enough to contribute to a good team at a D1 level. You know, we went to the College World Series and I wasn't even on the travel squad. I redshirted that entire year, not because I was hurt, but because I wasn't good enough. We hosted the Super Regional. I watched our team dogpile on Santa Clara's field because Cal wasn't a nice enough facility to host Super Regionals. But I watched from the stands. You know, I watched all my best friends who poured the same blood, sweat, and tears into the work that I did. And they got to celebrate and go on to Omaha, which is, you know, what you look for in college baseball. So I promised myself, I definitely promised myself in the summer of 2011 that I was going to do whatever it takes to contribute. And the next time we had success, I wanted to be a part of it. And so that's kind of when, that's what came into play when I switched sidearm. You want me to tell that story?
Yeah. Walk me through that. Cause if I have it correctly, that you essentially owe a teammate who swiped your jersey or who wearing a different jersey or something like that. You owe that person probably a portion of your career earnings.
Yeah, I do. So I was waiting to throw a midweek bullpen at the end of my junior year. The guy ahead of me, who was finishing up his bullpen, was wearing the wrong practice jersey, which we got 2 a year and we were juniors. So he had lost all 6. And, you know, my pitching coach at the time, Mike New, who's now the head coach at Cal, said, "What are you doing wearing number 37? You know, I picture a big power outfielder, corner, a lot of pop. And I thought, oh, that's interesting that you have certain preconceptions about
jersey numbers, what do you picture when you see 26, which was my number? And he said, oh, there was a sidearmer from UCLA whose name is David Berg, who's number 26. And there's a sidearmer from Washington, actually. I think he's also number 26. And he looked at me and he said, you know, have you ever thrown that way? And I said, nah. He's like, all right, step up, try it right now. And I was around the zone. It didn't hurt. It felt kind of natural. And I was probably like 83, 85. And he was like, look, if you can throw strikes like this and you find an off speed, like, you're going to pitch in college. Like, you're going to get that natural movement sidearm. You're going to get ground balls. You will pitch more. And I said, okay. And he's like, all right, that's how you throw now. Go off to summer ball, go through some growing pains. It's not a gimmick. It's not a trick. Take it serious. Watch video, get stronger. And like, we can make this work. And so, yeah, I definitely owe some of my, I definitely wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Justin Jones.
So take me through that process, because I want to kind of nerd out on the converting slider, because you have this repertoire and this delivery that you've been pitching with for years, since you get into high school. You're this one guy. In a second, you're a new guy. You've got to somehow, it's not like MLB The Show where you change your guys, you change your create a player's motion or whatever, and all his pitches suddenly translate.
Yeah.
How, going into summer ball, that process, how much stuff did you have to tinker with? How much different stuff did you try as far as spinning a break or working on a changeup? Where were you at and command of pitches and what you had from the start of summer ball to, I guess, the beginning of your junior season at Cal?
So I watched a lot of video of a guy named Joe Smith, who's obviously, ton of success, a long, long career in the big leagues. And then I watched guys like Dan Quisenberry, Darren O'Day, and they're all a little bit different in terms of how low they get, what their sliders look like. You know, Darren O'Day pitches a lot up in the zone, kind of comes from below, gets a little rise on it, especially with that slider, little tight one, that's like 82 to 83. And so I was trying to find about how low I would go with my arm slot. I really didn't understand how low I wanted to go. Do I want to be a knuckle scraper, Chad Bradford style? Do I want to tilt my head, tilt my shoulders, my spine? And that was something I had to tinker with for a while, because once I went past a certain point to the side, I would lose concept of the strike zone. My proprioception about where my body parts were lost once I like tilted past a certain degree. So I had to stay upright and keep my spine upright in order to know where my body was going. So that was the first step. Second step was finding an off-speed pitch that I could throw consistently for a strike. And that was my changeup first. I was getting hit so hard in Bend, Oregon that I almost abandoned a slider completely, which would be insane for a sidearmer to do. So yeah, I think my changeup came first, and I was lifting 6 days a week. I was playing catch with this kid named Derek Peterson, who went to Gonzaga, who was a pretty low arm slot guy. And we tinkered with grips together about what kind of sinker grips, two seam width, two seam across, kind of split. I really didn't hear the term one seam until I got a little bit older, and definitely not that summer. So fingers together, fingers apart, where's our thumb, stuff like that. And I put on maybe 10 to 15 pounds. My velo went from 83, 85 to 86, 88. And the slider didn't come for 6 to 10 months, 8 to 12, maybe. Because it would always slip out of my hand and kind of cast out, hit a right-hander in the butt, or I'd yank it and it would just yank to the left-handed back overcompensate. I couldn't find that sweet spot for a very long time. So I was mostly fastball changeup my fourth year at Cal, and then that slider came, and then I found a little bit more success.
How long did it take to have confidence? You step on the rubber, I'm this guy, I can do this.
6 months. 6 months when I started facing my own players in fall ball, and they had faced me in previous fall balls for the first 3 years. And they said, this is different, bro. Like, throw that fastball in the zone. It's not flat. And
that feedback allowed me to gain some confidence and start challenging hitters more. And so like I'd fall behind 2-0 and I said, all right, hit it. Here we go. Hit it as far as you can. And some guys would just ground out to short. And I'd be like, okay, like I can work with this.
Curious after two years plus a redshirt year of being mop up guy or just a guy, do you remember the first meaningful action you got? Like you're in a game, they're turning to me because this matters.
Yeah. I pitched in a college tournament in Houston. We played at the Astros Stadium and I faced
the college classic
with Rice and UNC was there. And I think the University of Houston. And I faced UNC was the number one team in the country at the time. And I remember facing Colin Moran and a guy named Sky Bolt, which how could you ever forget a name like Sky Bolt?
I think BA was still doing, they do this every year. I think they were doing the best names in college baseball list. And I think Sky Bolt was a top fiver.
For sure. So I felt, and I was kind of a big baseball, still college baseball fan. So I knew who we were playing and I got Sky Bolt out, but Colin Moran singled like first pitch. So comfortable, like saw it all the way swinging. But I went 3 innings, put up zeros. Like I got 3 zeros against the best team in the country, supposedly the best team in the country. And that was the first meaningful action. We were losing, but meaningful action in terms of pitching in a relatively close game against a good team, and I had success. And that is what I remember.
So a year before that, you had been mop-up guy, and then now you're getting Sky Bolt out, who I don't think he went in the first round, but was gonna be a guy,
mm-hmm.
and gonna be a professional baseball player. When did you, in your mind, think I could ride this beyond Cal?
I think when I struck Michael Conforto out, that was towards the end of the year we were eliminated from regionals, and I started. Literally starting games on Saturdays, and I had a good outing against Washington. I think I went 7, got a win, and then we faced Oregon State on Pac-12 Network the next week, and I loaded the bases with no outs in the first, and then I got out of it with like a comebacker to me, and then I punched Conforto out, and then I got another ground ball or whatever, and I thought I just got out of a big jam in Corvallis against a first rounder who was for sure going to be a big leaguer. I think in college, that was one of the first guys that I looked at and was like, that guy's going to play big league baseball. No doubt in my mind. And because I remember he like robbed a home run, threw a guy out of the plate and hit a home run like within 2 innings. And it was just super impressive. So striking him out was like, I can get good hitters out. Like I can get good hitters out consistently. If I just execute my pitches, I can get guys out. And so that was the first time that I remember being confident that I could play Pro Bowl.
What, before you had switched to sidearm, what was the game plan post-college? Cause I assume you had thought about that.
Film critic. Wanted to be a film critic, which thank goodness I didn't take that route. I don't think
we're gonna have to get you a big screen sports though.
yeah, we are. But
so with that, when does becoming a film critic? And I mean, we might have to unpack that deep. That is, you're the first person who's had an interesting an answer for what the post baseball career is. How long until that becomes Plan B? Was it after that junior year?
No. So I pitched that year a lot, but I don't have a lot of success. I mean, I'm pitching a lot, but I'm not putting up good numbers, not good enough to get drafted. I got a couple letters. I remember the Marlins thought about maybe a non-drafted free agent or like a late senior sign, save money type pick. My scholarship was up. I had finished my requirements and I had walked and like thrown my cap and gown and all that. That summer, I didn't get drafted. And again, came to terms with baseball being out of my life, hung them up. That was it. That was a wrap. I'm like benching every day in the student gym. Just the worst thing ever for my shoulder.
And August rolls around. I'm finishing up summer school. I just need units left. All my requirements for my major are done. My coach calls me and says, hey, this incoming freshman unexpectedly signed late, and we actually have scholarship money. Do you want to play a fifth year? And I was with my girlfriend at the time, now wife, and her sister. And I looked at them and I was like, what do you think? Should I go to college another year? I didn't really have anything lined up. I wanted to be a film critic, but I didn't have a job or anything lined up. And they're like, yeah, why not? Like, that sounds fun. Play as long as you can. So I went back after dodging, you know, life after baseball again. And I found a better slider. And I found a little bit more velo. And I was old enough and confident enough to start to take a leadership role on the team. And then I pitched a lot and I had a lot of success. And then I got drafted. And then after I got drafted, it still took me, I thought, okay, this will be fun for a couple years, but it's not really like a career thing for me. And then it took me about a year and a half to gain the confidence to be like, wait, I could pitch in the big leagues. I think I could get everybody out.
I need to go back to that August, because you on a whim had to decide, I need to figure out what I'm going to do for grad school.
Yeah, well, I don't think I was going back to grad school, that's for sure. But I needed to find out what job that I wanted to enter, and I just didn't have a clue. I mean, I wanted to be a film critic, and I had some pieces that I had written for some classes. I took a Kubrick class and a Spielberg class and a Japanese film class, and I had some nice pieces that I was thinking about sharing or sending around, but I never did that. And yeah, I literally had 2.5 weeks less of summer school, and then I was out of there.
So what did you do for class that last year?
Oh, in the summer summer classes I bailed. This class is my fifth year. I had to take a full semester, a full course load in the fall, but in the spring I could just take, they had this like reduced course load for fifth years. You could take one semester of under the you know, the full-time student load. So I took all electives. I took another film class. I took astronomy, which I thought was super cool, like everything that I was interested in. And I was loving college. Fourth and fifth year, I loved school. Whereas my first 3 years, I really had a hard time finding out what I wanted to do and applying myself in the classroom. But I started to do that. I was enjoying baseball more. I was enjoying college more. So yeah, that fifth year at Cal really, really was important.
So you're a senior, you're closing out games. Like you're the guy in the bullpen. You're having a lot of success. You're looking at getting drafted. What did, like, a lot of guys who succeed in college do so, maybe not right away, but pretty early. What the perspective, coming from the perspective of the guy who did not get to play a lot his first 3 years in college.
Yeah.
How much, like, what did that perspective grant you in your senior year that you might not have had you maybe had success from the get-go?
I really think the advantage of, I wasn't scared to get cut or to have this be my final outing or to have this to fail. I wasn't scared to fail because I had done it so much my first 3 years. I mean, I remember a fall league, a fall game where it's just you, you know, it was called the Blue Gold Series, and you just split your team into two and you pitch against yourself. And we had an 8-run lead in the ninth, and I gave up 9 runs, got one out, including 2 comebackers off of me that like hit my body, like hit my back and hit my leg. So insult to injury. And, you know, everybody's talking a little bit of shit because it's your teammates. You're having fun out there and everybody's talking shit at first. And then they stopped talking shit like 6 runs in because they felt bad.
That's even worse.
So much worse, bro. So much worse because they feel bad for you. And but they're still getting hits. And it culminated in this 3-run walk-off homer. And I remember sitting in the shower, and we had a handicapped seat in the shower, and I sat there for maybe 45 minutes and just let the water run over me. This is before I switched sidearm. And, I didn't find this out till later, but a younger guy told me that they ended up calling that the Hildenberger seat after I left for like 3 years. So I didn't know about that at the time.
You made your mark on the program.
That was funny. Yeah. But yeah, I think I wasn't afraid to fail. I had no pressure. I applied no pressure on myself to hit a certain level of success or to, you know, hit a certain velocity or whatever. I just thought that I was the funky guy having success now.
So you get drafted in the 22nd round by the Twins. Pro ball, life in the GCL, complete dream job with zero downsides?
Yeah. That's one way to put it. I think it was a pretty eye-opening experience in terms of I was 23, so I was 5 years older than the median average age there. The baseball quality of baseball took a step back, and I wasn't making much money. I think I was making $1,100 a month, living in the team dorms, which are $17 a day taken out of your paycheck, and it was like $185 every 2 weeks. And I had student loans I had to pay off, which were accruing interest faster than I could pay them down. So those are going up. I can't afford to fly my girlfriend out. Even if she did, we'd have to buy a hotel room because they can't stay in the dorms. But I'm pitching well. So like, that's cool. And that just kind of continued to happen throughout the minor leagues.
You finish that first year, you do mainly in the GCL, you get one appearance in the Appy League.
Yeah.
How that offseason and then the ensuing off seasons when you're a minor leaguer, did you have to spend your off season for the things that you mentioned? You're not making much money, you have student loans. Were you able to train full time?
Yeah, so that first off season, I got a job at a sporting goods store called Charlie Rose Baseball in Campbell, California, where I worked 9 to 5 selling baseball stuff, gloves and bats and cleats to little kids who were playing baseball, which was actually a really fun job. But I had to wake up super early so I could go to Gold's Gym. I still use my Cal ID to get a student discount. I would lift in the mornings. I would go work 8 hours. And then I would try to get off fast enough to go find daylight and throw with another guy in my area who was also still playing pro ball at the time. So they were long days. And I was living at home. And my girlfriend was living at her parents' house. So we saw each other as much as we could, but we weren't living together. It was hard on our relationship. And I think it was hard on my parents because they're still supporting me. I'm paying for all my own supplements and gym memberships and baseballs and trying to find a mound to throw on and following the Twins program, you know, to a T in terms of throwing program and like conditioning. Because I didn't have a routine that I thought worked for myself. I was very much impressionable by everyone around me. If I saw them doing something, I'd be like, oh, let me try that. Maybe that'll like be the key. So that first off season was really long and really tough. And then the second off season, I was playing in the fall league. So that season was super long. I played up until Thanksgiving. I had a short turnaround to the next off season. And then at the end of 2016, ended up getting hurt. So I was in rehab again till about Thanksgiving. So I didn't have time to get a seasonal job, even though I needed it.
Not to jump too far ahead into like your career, but just comparing off seasons from early in your career where you needed to work, you needed to be able to live, to after you've made it to the big leagues, you have those big league paychecks, you're able to, you know, train, focus on your job full time. How big a night and day difference is that in how you came into spring training every year?
Enormous. Yeah, enormous. I think one of the biggest advantages is the way you take care of your body when you have the resources to do it in terms of sleep and sleep quality. You don't have to get up early if you don't want to. The food, the quality of food that you're putting in your body, you don't have to get fast meals anymore. You don't have to. I was trying to put all my nutrients in one smoothie. I remember putting raw eggs and like zucchini in smoothies, and it ended up being disgusting, but I was trying to put, you know, everything that my body needed in a smoothie on the go. And plus it was cheaper than going to a juicery or something like that and getting something for me. So I think just having the resources to take care of your body, cause that's really your moneymaker, and to rest and recover. And my first year in the big leagues, I played with a guy named Matt Belisle, and I was lucky enough to be his catch play partner for that season. And he was so kind to me and so generous with his knowledge that you know, he told me that you're always in one of three phases. You're either competing, recovering, or preparing. There's no downtime in the big leagues, especially as a reliever. You have to be ready 162 games. Doesn't matter if you've thrown three in a row, four out of five, seven out of eight. You threw three innings last night, 70 pitches. We do not care. Be ready. Have your cleats on, stretch. And that sort of mentality in terms of no breaks, keep your foot on the gas. Immediately when you're done pitching, you're recovering. You start recovering immediately. There's no time to have drinks or to go out late or to whatever. You are immediately recovering, and then you wake up the next day and you're preparing to go compete again. So having a guy like that and a resource like that, I think helped me a long ways in terms of my consistency and taking care of my body.
Well, back into your first season, 2015, you're going out to low A as a 24-year-old. How much, as a California guy, how much cold weather baseball had you played in your life?
Ooh, very little. Very little. Cedar Rapids was quite a wake-up call.
I can imagine. But being like a bowling ball sinker guy, that plays in pretty well the cold weather, because no one wants to take one off the handle.
Yeah.
In the cold.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Yeah, I definitely had good. I think I had good numbers against righties that season, especially early in the year, because I could just kind of throw a 1-0 sinker inside and they'd either take it or just ground out.
So with it, it'd been a year since you got out of Cal. You turn in a 0.8 ERA in low A, still pretty good, you know, good numbers in high A. You go to the fall league. We talked like repertoire and building yourself as a pitcher earlier. What gains came in that first year as a professional, where you put up a lower ERA as a professional than you did your senior year at Cal, which was a good year.
I think my changeup, especially to right-handers, became my pitch of choice and my weapon, where in college I might have done fastball slider to righties and fastball changeup to lefties, and I didn't throw my slider to lefties and I didn't throw my change up to righties. And I started doing that in 2015, and I started incorporating time, mixing with guys' timing, coming set, having a really high leg kick, or coming set, holding for a long time, really high leg kick, fastball, next pitch, coming quick set, slide step, change up. And that, my pitching coach that year was Henry Bonilla, and he helped me with that in terms of like, there are ways to get guys out that have nothing to do with your stuff, that have nothing to do with your metrics or your velo, and you can mess with guys with that kind of stuff. You know, ask for a new ball and throw it in super high and super slow to the catcher and try to see if the guy tracks it. If the guy tracks that super slow ball, next pitch fastball, try to blow him up because he just saw a pitch at 47 basically. So it was those kind of tricks that allowed a guy like me who doesn't have the best stuff in the world to feel advanced and to have some success.
When you go to the fall league, you're facing, there are multiple guys in every lineup who are going to be a big leaguer. It's a bunch of Michael Confortos in the fall league. After that experience, what does that do for your own personal belief of I'm going to be a big leaguer too?
It's still not solidified. I think it's kind of like I'm tricking them and I'm going to keep tricking them, but I don't really believe that I'm going to be a career big leaguer at this point. But playing with guys, the Twins guys that sent were Taylor Rogers, Adam Brett Walker, who's playing for the Tokyo Giants right now, Stuart Turner, who played a year with the Reds, Mitch Garver, Jake Reed, Nick Birdie. So there were a lot of talented guys on that roster, and I felt privileged to play with them. And then the other guys on my team were like Clint Frazier, Austin Slater, Sam Travis, Jacoby Jones. We have a few, I mean, a lot of big leaguers on that team. But I didn't feel like I was elite or heads above them. So it wasn't really until 2016 in Double A where I was putting up good numbers that I was like, all right, I got this.
Well, in 2017, you're throwing well in Triple A. If you've had the moment in Double A of like, I've got this, is there then another moment where it's, I'm ready. I need the call. I've done what I can do here.
Absolutely. About 2 weeks before I got called up, I was calling my agent like, yo, what do I got to do? Like, what do I have to do to get my opportunity? Because I think the you know, when you're in the minor leagues, especially in Triple A, you're looking at the big league roster like, I'm better than this guy. This guy has a five. I'm better than this guy, which is just unfair and not the truth. But it's definitely how you think, especially when you haven't got a shot yet. And so I was calling my agent like, tell me what I need to work on. Is it my OPS against celebrities or something? I got to hold runners better, or what is it? And he's like, just be patient. Keep doing what you're doing. And you'll get your shot. And sure enough, June 22nd, 2017, I got called into the office. And my manager, Mike Quadi, started busting my chops about pace of play. Like, you're not delivering the ball quick enough. Like, you need to get, you get rosin too much and you're cleaning your cleats and you're tying your cleats. Like, what are you doing? Like, deliver the ball. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I didn't even pitch tonight. Like, why are you writing me about this? And he goes, well, you're going to have a chance to work on that in Minnesota. And that's a moment you never forget, especially as a player. My parents were actually in town. So I got to go upstairs. We were in Rochester. I got to go upstairs and tell them face to face, which was really, really special. Then they had a rental car, drove from Rochester to Cleveland that night. I flew in the morning, and they were there that night, and I pitched that first day in the big leagues. And like, I pitched the ninth inning of a 5-0 ball game, I think.
I was going to say, your debut, you get to finish a game. A lot of debuts come in complete garbage time. That's one, if you let three guys on,
I'm gone.
Then you're gone.
Like, you couldn't do it. Like, get out. I appreciated Paul Molitor, the manager at the time, getting me as soon as possible so I didn't have to like sit on it. And he knew, you know, everybody knows that your family and your friends are all there watching. And so you don't want to wait too long to get a kid in. So it's 5-0. And I'm sitting in the pen thinking, I've done my routine. I'm sitting in the pen like, is 5 enough to let a rookie make his debut? It's kind of close. And we're playing Cleveland. Like, they're ahead of us in the standings. Or we're like a game out or whatever. Like, is this the time? And so sure enough, I call down, Eddie Guardado picks up and he looks at me and he just goes, you. And I don't think he knew how to pronounce my name, you know, because it's kind of long and kind of a mouthful. And I kind of choked on the cup of water I was drinking. But I started warming up. I tell the catcher to get down. First pitch, bah, dotted, outside corner. Second pitch, boom, dotted. On the black. Third pitch, bang, dotted. I didn't throw a strike the rest of the pen after the first three. And I was like, okay, like, these are getting too good. Let's spike one here. You know, if you're a reliever, you know that if you're too good in the pen, then you're going to be bad in the game. And if you're really bad in the pen, you're probably going to be nasty and punch the side up. In Cleveland, the bullpens are super high in right center, and there's a long stairway down. They're metal stairs. And I remember the security guard telling me, like, hey, be careful. Like, don't trip and roll your ankle. It's like, okay, man, thanks for putting that in the back of my mind. So I go in. Castro meets me at the mound. They tell you not to look up. And the first thing he does is, like, look around, man. Isn't this the coolest place ever? And so I kind of, like, snap my neck around the stands, see how high the light towers are. And, face Roberto Perez, Brad Zimmer, Kipnis, and Jose Ramirez. Got through it. No runs.
Scoreless frame.
Yeah.
Okay, so hat tip to another podcast you did that was on today, day we're recording. Everyone go check out Tipping Pitches, best in the game. You talked about there's kind of a mentality when you were in the minors, and like I've had guys on this show say this, minors is the grind. It's supposed to be tough, that, you know, that sort of thing, life in the minors. If you just read the stats, says you did great in the minors, kind of flew through them in a couple of years, great timing, you know, no great shakes. How accurate is that reality? What prior working conditions, I mean, we're making progress as a sport now, compared to when you came up, but like, what did prior and some current working conditions do to a guy off the field, even when he excels on the field?
Well, I know that my situation, my conditions, ended up giving me long-term anxiety and anxiety attacks. I think at the end of 2016, I had just rehabbed a flexor injury. I had a good year in AA, but I wasn't, you know, making good enough money to support myself, really. Still living at home. I kind of had felt like a burden on my girlfriend at the time, who was, when we go out to eat, she's paying. When we go on a vacation, she's paying. And so we went on this vacation to London that her work had kind of paid for. She had a big conference, and then that whole vacation, she had paid for most everything. I had like $150 to my name. And on the flight back, we had some turbulence, and I'm not a great flyer to begin with. So I buy Wi-Fi to kind of just distract myself. I'll just scroll Twitter and, I don't know, play games, do something to not think about the plane shaking. And then I opened Twitter and I learned that my teammate had passed away in a car accident in the Dominican, a Venezuelan teammate. His name was Yorman Landa. And that was it. I mean, that pushed me over the edge. Tight chest, hyperventilating. And I just couldn't understand, you know, why I was doing what I was doing. I think I put a lot of pressure on myself and a lot of factors. You know, I was in debt, student debt, and a lot of factors played into the fact that I had anxiety, but definitely the working conditions in the minor leagues didn't help and the pay didn't help. I felt like I was treading water at best. I was a burden a little bit on my family and my girlfriend. Of course, they never said this, and that's not true, but it's how I viewed it.
With that, I mean, your appearance on Tipping Pitches kind of talked about especially the strides that we've made, and now it looks like there's going to be a recognized minor league union, hopefully working towards better conditions for minor league baseball players. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to speak from the reply guy on Twitter point of view, the guys who are always in your tweets, other guys' tweets. Oh, you play a kid's game. Oh, I would do it for free. Oh, yada this, yada that. When you think about if the union or if minor league baseball players, if conditions just approved across the board and they were treated like, say, minor league hockey players, mm-hmm. or reach something of that level where it was considered a career, not a, you know, not what I think
seasonal.
Called in the Save America. Yeah, seasonal employee. Thank you, the Save America's Pastime Act. If we're speaking from, I guess, the owner's point of view or the whoever's point of view, mm-hmm. that, you know, aside from the fact that it is just the right thing to do to treat a workforce like a workforce and invest in your employees and treat people like people and treat labor as it should be treated, what benefit to the sport of baseball do you think would come just as a whole, professional baseball, if minor league baseball players were treated as full-time employees, full-time year-round employees who didn't have to worry about paying their bills in the off season?
I think it's twofold. I think from a player development standpoint, you're going to get the best out of your players if they are sleeping well, if they are eating right, if they are lower cortisol levels, if they, you know, are recovering better. I think if they're living in poor housing conditions with no AC when it's 100 in Tennessee, they're sleeping really poorly, and they're not gonna, you know, we talk about sleep as a performance in a high performance environment, and we talk about how much water you drink and how much food you eat and what food you put in your body. And when guys can only afford to go to Wendy's, or guys are trying to make their meals stretch and are eating PB&Js three times a day at the field, that's not the best thing for that player development. So criminally underpaying guys in that aspect hurts the game, hurts the product of baseball. And I've also seen players who I thought had the talent and the work ethic to be a big leaguer quit because it's untenable. They were having trouble paying for diapers and paying for baby formula and supporting their family. And they chose to go to another industry. Like, I could be a UPS driver, or I could do something else. I could write. I could join my dad's company. I could do anything else that makes more money faster. I don't have to outplay everybody in my class. And I could also have a career injury at any point. But I think we're losing out on talent. And like I said, player development. If we just paid everybody better, people could stay in the game longer. They could treat their bodies right. And ultimately, I think that would lead to better baseball players.
I couldn't agree more. Because there's the adage of, and when people who talk negatively about the minor leagues say, you know, it's these 22 guys are playing so these other three guys can play.
Yeah.
And it sounds like there's a lot more with better conditions, there'd be a lot more than three guys. Because there are guys who will just never make the big leagues just in the cards.
I think not everybody who plays minor league baseball is going to play big league baseball. We know that. Just as a numbers game, it's not going to work. There's only 750 big league jobs, and there's 5,400 minor leaguers. So we know that it's not everybody, but it could be anybody. And that, I think, is one of the most beautiful things about baseball, is that you ain't got to be 6'9" to have success. And you can find a tool that you do really well, or two tools that you do really well, and attack your weaknesses. If you identify what you do well and identify what you do poorly, you can attack your weaknesses, make them into strengths, if not that strengths, but not weaknesses. And you can have no holes and outplay anybody and get hot at the right time, and then be in the big leagues, take advantage of an opportunity and stick. So I think, from a perspective of why I love baseball as a sport, I think that that's a big one. But yeah, for the minor leagues, not everybody, but anybody.
So you get that call back to your playing career.
Yeah.
You get that call. And when you're up, you're up. You're there the rest of the season on that playoff run. You mentioned Matt Belisle kind of showed you the ropes, how to take care of your body, so on and so on. Just in general, how big is the learning curve to just learn how to be a big leaguer? Not the game. You've got the game stuff down. You turn a pretty good year, but it's a different kind of travel, different kind of, you know, spotlight on you, things like that. Like, how long does it take to learn to be a big leaguer off the field?
I don't know if I ever got there, but I think a couple months. You kind of learn the ropes of how to carry yourself, how to handle fans who approach you in the streets or at a restaurant. Not that that happened to me a ton. I don't think I was the most recognizable player as a middle reliever on a small market team, but you kind of, at first, you're kind of just wide-eyed, especially playing with guys like Joe Mauer and Jason Castro and Brian Dozier and Eduardo Escobar. I felt that I knew these guys and I had looked up to them, and now they're your colleagues and your teammates. And so that takes a little bit of getting used to. And then once you get the belief that you belong and that you're good, then everything falls into place, especially, you know.
Is there anyone who got in the box and you were, like, admittedly starstruck?
Cabrera. Miguel Cabrera. He's just big. And not only is a big name, but he's a big guy. And he got in. I said, this guy won the triple crown. I know this guy. I know who this is. So yeah, I think that was the first and only guy. Because the other, by the time I had faced other MVPs, I had a bit more time and a bit more confidence.
When you get up, do you change anything about how you go about your business on the mound? Like, does pitching against, I can't remember who I heard say this, but like the only, like the big leagues, like there's AAA in the big leagues, but there are guys like Mike Trout is playing like 72A. Like there's only, you know, when you're playing against guys who have reached just the top tier in skill, did you change how you went about anything? Or did you just take, I'm going to do the same thing I had success in AAA and I'm going to try to replicate it here?
Yeah, I think the latter, because I think that was what was preached to us. Like, listen, you were called up for a reason. Keep doing what you're doing. If we didn't think you were good enough to be here, you wouldn't be here. You get guys out. These are human beings. If you execute your pitch in the right spot at the right time, they're going to be out. And they miss pitches. I remember throwing a fastball down the middle to Cabrera, and he took it. And I said, oh, I just got away with a big mistake. And then I think I hung a slider to Justin Upton, and he fouled it back. And I said, I just got away with another mistake. These guys aren't perfect. Like, I got a little margin for error. I don't got to throw the nastiest pitch to the perfect spot every time. And so that kind of experience and just the attitude of a competitor, that like, I can get you out. I don't really care who you are. Like, I can get you out. Yeah, I didn't change too much on the mound when I got to the big leagues.
2018, your first full season. It's just stats wise, it's bumpier than your rookie year.
Yeah.
What is the, and I guess this applies to just being in the minors in general, just the work process of reliever starters. You get your, you know, you get your rest time, you get your recovery day, you get your bullpen day, whatever. You've got the set routine to work on stuff. 2018, you're pitching in almost half your team's games.
Mm-hmm.
There's not really, kind of like you said earlier, there's not really, you've got to be ready every day. You're either, you know, resting, preparing, or, you know, recovering, preparing, or competing.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you get work in, especially if like you come off an outing, you know, a tough outing or two in a row, and you're like, I've got to work out some kinks or something like that. Like how do you strategically get that work in and get that game intensity in while also remaining consistently ready to pitch in 73 games in a season?
I think you do it in catch play with your catch partner. You gotta, I mean, you do that every day no matter what. And you gotta trust your catch partner, and he's gonna know you the best in terms of like your stuff looks good, or listen, you're a little bit off. I think you need to finish more or a stronger front side or whatever it is. And my catch play partner was Taylor Rogers, and he was really good at that. Really good feedback, paid attention. And then you can throw pregame. You can get off the mound. And it doesn't have to be with a baseball. You can kind of get off the mound and just go through your delivery and work on stuff with your pitching coach or your bullpen coach. And you could do it without a baseball to put no stress. But it is a tough time to, if you need to work on actually throwing the field of pitch, it is tough to find a place to work on it. Sometimes you work on it in games. Sometimes you work on it on the fly. I got to try a new thumb placement on my slider. And then, you know what? The first time I'm going to throw it, it's going to be to Jose Altuve. That's just the way it has to be right now. And I got to find a way to get him out, whether or not I have my best stuff. And I think that first half of the calendar year, I was having a lot of success. And then I had this outing in Chicago. I think I gave up like five getting it out. And I don't want to say it's all downhill from there, but it was a gradual slide from that point. I had the opportunity to close for a little bit, and that was really fun and really cool, and pitching some big moments. And mentally, you know, I gave up a walk-off homer to Lindor, and then I had to come back a night or two later and get a save, I believe, in Cleveland and get Lindor out. And that is the kind of stuff that you need to do. You need to have a short memory and flush it and come back and get the same guy out who got you last time. That's what the big leagues is about, is getting a guy out, not once, not twice, but 20 out of 25 times in a season or whatever it is. Like, you got to find a way to get the same guy out over and over and over again, especially in your division, especially if you're going to be there for year after year after year. And once the league figures you out, you have to make adjustments back, and then becomes a battle of adjustments about setting up what you used to do and changing those expectations and mixing it up. So that's the mental side of the game that I really enjoy. I wasn't able to do it all, but I was trying.
Well, 2019, you at the end of the season, you get non-tendered, obviously probably not what you had hoped. What positives come out of getting non-tendered, especially, I mean, as I think as a professional athlete, you have to look at whatever the next thing is something you can compete or a chance, basically. Like, what were you able to pull out of that wasn't the end of the world?
Yeah, fresh start. I could go into a new organization and mentally flush my last few years of bumpiness and kind of attack a new challenge, attack my weaknesses, identify what I was bad at, and try to get better. And I think, you know, I found out I was non-tendered, and I found out my wife and I were pregnant like 3 days apart. So we went from dual income, no kids, to one income, kid on the way. And we were like, all right, like, we got to go. Like, I got to get going and find a way to do this again. So it's definitely a challenge, but it's kind of fun at the same time.
You've had now, since that non-tenary, it's been weird for everyone.
Yeah.
It's been very weird, for you. You know, the COVID season hits, you do time in the Mets alternate site. Some time with the Mets, you get hurt, you rehab. It's been essentially a 2-year process without you pitching a ton of meaningful baseball.
Yeah.
You mentioned when you got non-tendered, a chance to figure out what you need to improve on, what you don't do well, need to improve on. And that 2 years, I'd imagine, has given you a lot of time to think, a lot of time to put the work in.
Yeah.
Who is Trevor Hildenberger, the pitcher now active on the San Jose Giants? Like, who is that guy versus the guy who got non-tendered in Minnesota?
Okay. Genuinely, from a baseball perspective, my slider is significantly better. I learned a new grip from Sergio Romo. I have my finger spread apart a little bit more, and I'm pulling on both seams of a two-seam grip. And the numbers don't lie. It has better movement. It's a higher spin rate, and it's about the same velocity. So my slider is better than it was at the end of 2019, no doubt. I understand what I do well and why I can get the ball to sink and what I need to do to get it to sink in terms of the spin axis being below 3 o'clock, in terms of where my thumb needs to be and my front side needs to be strong. So all this stuff, especially in the rehab process, when you're like learning to throw again after not throwing for 6 months, you really are hypercritical about every body movement. Changeup and sinker are still there. I think, you know, I'm never going to be a guy that lights up the radar gun, but I'm 31. My body feels good. Next year, I'll be entering my 32 season. I think that I have a good head on my shoulders. I'm competitive, and I'm going to come prepared every day to get hitters out. So, yeah, I think I'm in a better place than I was at the end of 2019, and hopefully finish this year strong and be ready to attack next year with everything I got.
Most guys on the show, I ask for like a retrospective, kind of asking you for the opposite. You're, like you said, you're 31. What do you want out of the rest of your career?
I sort of have made it my goal to play as long as I can until my daughter can kind of have memories of me playing, which is still a couple more years. She's 2 now. So that's a long way to go. But what do I want the rest of my career? I want to enjoy the time with my teammates. I think coming up, especially I'll speak for myself, hyper competitive. I had to outpitch everybody as a senior sign in the 22nd round. They took, I don't know, 8 college relievers ahead of me that all threw 95 plus. So I not only had to outperform the organization's expectations of me, but I had to outpitch everybody else almost twice as much, because I think that when a guy like me has success in the minor leagues, it's like, all right, maybe it's a fluke for a month, whatever. Okay, like, he's doing it after 6 weeks, but can he keep doing it? And I had to do it over and over and over again. And maybe I didn't enjoy the time with my teammates and stuff like that. So hopefully this time around, I can, yeah, really enjoy and kind of, I mean, help players for sure. Part of this unionization push, I think that I've helped guys understand, open their eyes in terms of how much value they bring, how much value their labor brings, what's important, you know, solidarity. And yeah, hope I can help guys reach the big leagues and stick. So kind of whatever I've learned, I'll try to pass it on.
This might step on the question I just asked, but the last thing I usually ask everyone is, you give yourself a pep talk right before you signed, like day of signing, go back and talk to that guy. What would that pep talk look like, that fifth year senior at Cal?
My self-talk is so many swear words. I don't know if I should say it on this podcast. I'll try to clean it up. Listen, it's time to grow up. You have to pour everything that you have into this. You can't half-ass it. You can't do two things at once. You really have to focus, figure out your priorities, find out what you want, and commit. And obviously, do all the right things when people are looking, but do all the right things when people aren't looking. When there's no one out there, do everything that you need to do, plus one, plus two. Because you got to outpitch everybody twice as hard. You have to get people out, like I said, not just once or twice, but 7 times, 10 times. And never let your foot up off the gas. Never, ever let your foot up off the gas. Keep getting better. Always keep getting better. Never be content. Never think like, well, my stuff is as good as it's going to be, or my mindset is as good as it's going to be. Like, keep getting better. We never stop growing, and that's part of the fun. So yeah, just keep that process churning and enjoy the time with your teammates and your friends.
I got a quick rapid fire for you, then I'll let you get out of here.
You got it.
Favorite minor league ballpark?
Great question. You know, I really liked Worcester.
Brand new.
Yeah, brand new. Only played there a few games, but good fans, good bullpen, good clubhouse.
Polar Park, if I remember correctly. Favorite big league ballpark?
To pitch in or?
Give me both. Pitch in and then kind of like just the aura, place you like being the best.
All right, well, to pitch in, it's Kansas City because it's massive. And they got really good barbecue on getaway days and great bullpens. Aura, Fenway, Dodger Stadium, and then the wild card game in 2017, Yankee Stadium, was unforgettable.
Best hitter you ever faced thus far?
Mookie Betts.
Okay, I've held in my Twins fanhood for 1 hour and 6 minutes. I need your best Joe Mauer story.
You know he's a big rap fan.
Shut up.
Yeah, huge rap guy.
You're fucking with me.
I'm dead serious. He loves rap. And he knew that I was into rap. And I forget who it was, but someone had just released a new album. And I was walking through the clubhouse, and he's like putting his socks on or whatever. And he's like, hey, Hildy, did you listen to, God, I should remember the artist's album. He's like, hey, did you listen to, you know, Blank's album? I said, no, but I will tonight. And I'll get back to you, sir, tomorrow, Mr. Mauer. Like, I went and listened to the whole album that night because I wanted to talk to him about it. But yeah, he's a big rap guy. Obviously, you know, he was going to go to Florida State to play football. And we saw him spin a football, and it's just like perfect every time. And guys used to pick off, not because they thought they had a chance or because they need to. No strategic incentive other than to watch Joe Mauer throw the ball back to them with a perfect four-seam spin right at their chest.
Of course. Other Twins question. What is the most athletic thing you've ever seen Byron Buxton do?
He hit an inside the park home run against the Diamondbacks where, you know, he hit it. I watched the ball. It hit off the top of the fence. I kind of peeked at him as he was rounding first. It hit off the top of the fence. And I was like, oh, he's got a chance. I looked up and he was rounding third. I thought, there's a runner on first. But there wasn't. He just did it all himself. It was like 3 strides between second and third. And then he made a catch for me in Toronto that I'll never forget.
and one in Cleveland that I also thought he had absolutely no chance at getting. Just, you know, you watch so much baseball, you see the ball and you see the player out of the peripherals and you kind of know, like, it's in the gap. And it wasn't. And so just some of the plays he made were special.
He is a literal gazelle. What is the local San Jose food spot that is a must?
Ooh. I mean, a San Jose staple is like La Victoria's Mexican food with the orange sauce is really, really good. And I would say, yeah, pick up some La Vix next time you're in San Jose.
Need to have a movie question. As far as you do a Saturday night double feature.
Yeah.
Two favorite, what's your go-to double feature?
Ooh. We're going to stick with thrillers. We'll do Korean thrillers and we'll do Memories of Murder. And I mean, Old Boy is always, I'm always going to watch Old Boy.
Old Boy is intense.
Last
one. Everyone gets this one. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
Of course. Yeah. AC breaks, bus breaks down. We're cooking. Open the emergency vent. Yeah. Toilet's broken. You know, no one can use a toilet. Just, I've memory hold that for sure.
Everyone has one. Trevor Hildenberger, that's all I've got for you. Thanks so much for joining from Phenom to the Farm.
Thank you, Kyle. Thanks for having me. A lot of fun.
And that's it for today's episode with Trevor Hildenberger. Big thanks to Trevor for stopping by, walking us through his career thus far. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure you're subscribed. Rate and review if you're on Apple Podcast. New episodes drop every 2 weeks, so we'll catch you then. Thanks for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.